This is the premiere episode of season two of the Sales Change Podcast. Hello, everybody. Episode one features Mike Weinberg. He's the author of three sales books. He's a sales coach and keynote speaker out of the United States. I'm a huge fan of Mike's, and we talk about how his books have affected my career over the last 10, 15 years. We talk about the COVID-19 situation. We touch on sales leadership, hiring legend salespeople that actually turn out to be failures. This is a really fun episode. I really wanted Mike on season one. I've managed to get him for the premiere episode of season two. Enjoy the episode. Remember, if you want more information on the episode, visit www.saleschange.co.uk/podcast. Sign up to the newsletter, get loads of information. Enjoy the episode. Welcome, Mike, to the Sales Change Podcast. This is the premiere episode of season two. How are you?
I am great, and it's always fun to visit with someone from the UK. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Mike, I've got to be honest with you. Your three books, I've read all three: Sales Management Simplified, New Sales Simplified, and Sales Truth. In fact, I've got Sales Truth in front of me here. I was just reading through it before we came on the podcast. Your book, Sales Management Simplified, completely changed my career. I'll be honest with you. All of the things that you laid out as tips and processes were exactly what a sales manager should do, but not necessarily how I was doing them. It just gave me that structure and that process to understand, actually, my guys need me in the field. They need me by their side. They need to understand what I want from them. So big shout out to you, Mike, honestly.
I feel like I owe you several pints of slightly warm and slightly undercarbonated beer.
Oh, we do that very well in the UK.
I would love to visit with you at one of your 500-year-old pubs and actually talk about this. So you're very kind. Thank you for your assessment of the book. And you know, we're going to get into sales management and talent management today. But I'm amazed at how little good sales management we see today, and how companies want to spend all this money on sales training, but never talk about the manager and that person's key role in developing people and coaching people up and working in the field. And I feel like so many executives have lost sight of what the actual job of the sales manager is. Very frustrating, very frustrating.
Is that why you wrote the book, Mike? Because you could recognize it in the industry?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons. And honestly, and I share this in chapter one, my transition from sales, and I was a top producer, and then I went into consulting and coaching, and then I went back and was a sales executive and sales manager. It was a very hard transition for me. I was beyond struggling in my first role as in sales management, and I didn't understand how hard it was and all the burden placed on you by the company and everyone's opinion about how you should do your job and how little time, if you don't own your priorities, how little time you spend doing the very few things that move the needle. Right?
Yep.
Coaching, accountability. And so I really struggled. So that's part of the reason I wrote it. And the other reason was I got tired of getting called into companies to come fix their, you know, open quote, sales problem, only to discover it was a management problem. It was culture. It was compensation. It was the wrong people in the wrong jobs. It was lack of accountability. And I could go on and on and on. And I felt like I needed to address this. And that's where I became a student of sales management. Because I realized that you and I are not going to transform sales organizations from the outside just helping the salespeople. We'll make a few people better, and we do all the time, and I love to do that. But if you really want to change the culture and have a healthy, high-performance culture and drive results for the long term, you have got to deal with leadership and culture and compensation and accountability and talent management. And that's not a lot of, those are not popular topics today.
So. You spoke about you found it difficult to transition into sales management. One of the first big lessons that I learned when I transitioned into sales management was when you're a top performing salesperson, nothing is impossible. When someone says to you, you need to do £500,000 this year, you automatically say, yeah, of course I can. And plus 10%. You understand that you have to be optimistic and you have to achieve. When I transitioned into sales management, saying yes all the time, it can be quite damaging. And that's on your head if your team don't find the results. So you have to honestly be truthful with what you can achieve and understand where you need to improve your team in order to create those results.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why so many sales managers are burned out today. You know, they forget that you need to win through your people and that you are the one who's ultimately responsible for achieving those results. And I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit today. So many managers are playing the hero and they're trying to do everybody's job for them. And, you know, they're not coaching, they're doing. They're not leading, they're doing. And it's a huge transition from being a selfish individual contributor whose job is to make your own number to pivoting to having to win through your people. Very different. And it was a very hard transition for me.
Honestly. One of the hardest things that I found when I started into sales management was when you're in a sales call with one of your salespeople is do not jump in straight away. I joined this role now and I manage a team of about 4 or 5 people in a sales capacity. And one of the first sales calls I did, the guy has been in the job for 35 years. So he understands the product. He understands the process. He knows what he's selling. The first call I ever went on him with, he sat down in front of his client and got out a catalog and then went through line by line what the new products were in the catalog. And I instantly just sort of started to shrivel up and feel like, come on, you can't do this. This isn't how you sell. You've got to understand what the client wants first. I felt this sudden urge to just jump in and say, no, don't do that. Do this. But you have to try and control the call without putting off the client, but without also annoying your sales staff so that they think that you're taking over. It's a real fine balance to find.
Oh, we could spend the whole episode talking about that one situation, right? How do you behave in front of a customer or a prospect alongside your salespeople? It's a very challenging situation. And because most of us in sales leadership were really good at sales, it's hard for us to watch somebody crumble on a sales call. But sometimes, and I talk about this in one of the chapters in the book, sometimes the value of letting them fail and the teaching moment that it creates is worth more than saving the outcome of that one meeting. Now, sometimes it's not. And if it's a really big customer or a really big opportunity, you know, my mercenary kicks in, right? My capitalist kicks in. I'm like, no, we're going to save this deal. But it's always a decision. When do you jump in and help? And when are you just playing the manager and elevating the conversation and asking some different questions? And when do you actually take over so the salesperson doesn't crash the airplane into the mountain?
Yeah.
And that's a great debate. I mean, when I lead a workshop, that's one of the exercises we go through.
What's the worst mistake you've ever heard of, Mike?
The worst mistake in a sales call?
Yeah.
I think it's the habitual manager of who, no matter what, because of their own ego or their own fear or their own lack of confidence in their talent, they continually do their salespeople's job. So they play the hero, right? Yeah. They're not trying to make the salesperson the hero. They want to be the sales team hero because they're a control freak or their ego gets in the way or they're insecure and it's awful. They want the credit for everything and they want to do everything. And that's the way to run off some really good talent. And it's also never going to develop somebody into the person you want them to become. And you know, Matt, I'll just ask you, one of my frustrations is I wonder where all the sales mentors have gone, right? Like when I was younger, part of the reason I got so good at sales is I had executives and sales managers mentor me. They put me under their wing. They showed me how to do the job. They traveled with me. They were really tough on me. But they also encouraged me and they set a standard of what performance looked like and they were involved in it. Today, managers are so buried in crap and so busy on corporate conference calls or playing in the CRM, they don't do the job of developing their people. It used to be a source of pride. Today, I don't even see managers care how they develop their people. I'm curious if you see the same thing.
To be honest, when I first started my sales career, and I think this goes down to why I'm so passionate about sales now, is my first sales manager, I'll give him a shout out. His name was John Bailiff. He sat with me for around about 3 to 6 months when I first joined the company. I shadowed him on visits. He shadowed me on visits. After every call, he gave me a breakdown of exactly where I went right, where I went wrong. In between calls, we'd talk about the preparation and how we were going to talk about the next client, what their problems were, how we were going to solve those problems, potential objections. All of that period of 3 to 6 months, he then, because of his talent, got moved and shuffled up the company. So I then had a different manager. But then my interactions with that manager became less and less. That manager was then, exactly as you described, buried in CRM, reporting the numbers, giving the reports to the board, telling them the forecasts. That's not a sales manager's job. A sales manager's job is to get results through their teams, right? So it was just, that was where the passion came from. I see now And I joined this company 2.5 years ago. And for 6 years, we've suffered a period of decline. When I joined, it was the first year of real success and a real period of growth. So we're in that period now. And thankfully, during the COVID-19 period, we've only seen, let's say, a 5 to 10% drop off in results. So it's not been too bad for us, touch wood. So what I saw when I joined this company is the sales manager before me, and I'm a general manager, so I run both the sales and production elements, but the sales manager before me was just completely hands-off, running their teams through an Excel spreadsheet and not being present in the field. My first 6 months here, I spent most of that time in hotels meeting with the salespeople, going out and understanding what their problems were, understanding what the client's problems were. And from that period, I call it the Super Nanny period. There used to be a television show in the UK called Super Nanny, where Super Nanny on the first day would go in and see what the parents' problems were, see what was happening with the children, the second day begin repairing it. So I was in my Super Nanny period where for the first 6 months, I was sat there just observing, just looking at what these problems were. Following that 6 month period, man, I've changed so much. We had 52 different discount codes at this company. We've reduced it all the way down to 4 because how can a salesperson get a job done when they can't even understand the discount structure? My sales reps were in the field. They couldn't send a quote to the client. It had to come through the office. So how can you create a relationship with a client and give them that instant reaction and an instant quote when you can't even send a quote? So Mike, I've seen all of these mistakes and more, honestly.
I cannot wait for my audience when we promote this podcast, for my audience to hear what you just shared in the last 5 minutes, because there's so much truth and there's so much real coaching for managers and for salespeople. There's so much in what you just said. I mean, one of the things I just want to point out to everyone before we move on is that description you gave of your mentor and your good sales manager helping you think through what to do in the meeting before you went in and who the people were and what their personalities were and what objections you would face and what questions you would ask and how you would define all that stuff. I don't see that happening today. And part of the reason when I'm teaching sales management in a workshop, I go through that in great detail and make them talk through what are the best practices for preparing your salespeople to make sales calls with or without you. Because if you coach them really well on all those things you just articulated, my hope is that they'll go through that same process or process, depending on where you're from, to prepare for that meeting when you're not around. You know, I think we just assume the salespeople are going to do a great job, but most salespeople stink on sales calls. They wing it. They don't have a plan. They're not prepared with the phases and the stages. And
Mike, they've just been given a piece of paper which says sales plan with these are your objections that you're going to have. They don't actually know how to fill that piece of paper out. So they get given this, it's a hands-off approach to sales management.
It's awful. It's awful. And you said it earlier, it's not optional. This is the job. I love the Super Nanny analogy. That's exactly what we should be doing, observing and then speaking into it after the fact. But when you're sitting at your desk and you said it, right, trying to manage with a spreadsheet, or, you know, in the book, I make fun of the CRM. I love CRM, but if you're a manager who lives with your head buried in your CRM screen, you're not leading anybody by sending them nasty emails and talking about spreadsheets. So you got to watch the people. You got to observe them.
I mean, my biggest mistake, Mike, just to bring it all the way back to the first question I asked you, my biggest mistake that I've made over the last few years is overconfidence. So when I know that I know my product inside out, I know that I think I know that what the client's going to have as an objection or as an agenda, not preparing an agenda, not preparing what the questions that I need to ask and not preparing what I'm going to do after the sales call, which is vitally important as well. That's where I fall down. So I get into this ego state where I think, oh, I know what I'm doing. I know how to handle this client. And then suddenly you get a curveball in the meeting that you haven't prepared for. So that'd be probably my biggest mistake.
Boy, and imagine if you're confessing to that, think about the reality. Because I see, and I'll go lead a workshop for salespeople. And I'll say, raise your hand if you've practiced conducting a sales call. Or raise your hand if in the last 10 years you've read a book or been through a course that showed you how to walk through the phases of a sales call. From building rapport, to sharing your agenda, to getting buy-in, to telling your story, to asking questions, fleshing out objections, nobody raises their hand. So, I mean, if you're saying, you're confessing that we sometimes get overconfident, the average salesperson isn't even giving any thought to what they do before they go into a customer meeting. It's pathetic. Yeah. And that's why we're getting outsold. And that's why our people get commoditized. And that's why they get put in what I call the procurement pit in the Sales Truth book, where you just follow along and do whatever the customer tells you, even though it gets you commoditized and you can't differentiate yourself. It's terrible, terrible.
So in these teams then, Mike, and we had a brief chat about this on Instagram at one point, but in order to change the team, so let's say we've been through that super nanny period and you know that you need to change some people because they're not effective salespeople. How would you go about recruiting a top performer? Because there are some warning signs out there. There are some people that sit in their bubbles, are able to sell in a company where they've made a comfortable space for themselves. They're the ones that get all of the inbound leads. They're the ones that are the go-to person in order to close the deal. How would you go about getting a top performer? And how would you recognize that they're not possibly a top performer? Because I've made this mistake. We had a brief chat before the podcast. I've made this mistake before.
Oh, Matt, I think this is the day we became friends on Instagram.
Yeah.
You put a very strong comment out. I had some type of quote about recruiting. And you came in with the strongest comment. And at first, it took me aback. And then when I read it a second time, I'm like, this guy is spot on. Because I've made the same mistake. Or I was the salesperson in the company and I watched executives make the mistake that you're articulating, where the company goes out and brings in some industry veteran, supposed top performer from a competitor or a similar type company. And the expectations are through the roof and they guarantee this person a ton of money in order to get them into the company. And they show up and they're a complete dud. They do nothing. And you just articulated the reasons. We don't ask the right questions. Sometimes these people that are working for our competitors or in similar companies that we think we really want, the only reason they're the top producer is because they've worked there for 10 years and they got all the best leads or the best patch of territory, right? They were given the cherry, right? That's an expression we use here in the States on cherry accounts. They were the perfect, you know, they were the perfect list of customers who had the need. So it's not like that person was a proven sales hunter. They just had the biggest numbers. And I have been in company after company, whether it's someone who's making top dollar that they call the best person, but they're really just a babysitter for the best accounts. So their numbers are really high, but they're not bringing in new business. They're just servicing accounts. And the one story I told in the book, and you've seen it, you've read the same story yourself.
Yeah.
Is you bring in that person and they're not hungry and they don't show you hunting skills. And they have a lot of opinions of how your company should do everything. And they're very happy to tell you and critique what's going on in your place, but they don't fill the pipeline with new opportunities, right? I mean, I personally have witnessed that, and you obviously have, and it's painful.
And the other flip side of the coin is, Mike, that they don't know how to fill their pipeline full of activities, or they've got this bank of clients that they take from company to company. And when that bank of clients has run out and they've sold the dream so many times, when they've run out of that bank of clients that they've transitioned from company to company, they've got nothing left. They haven't got the skills in order to close further down the road.
Yeah, or not the skills or the desire, because they're fat and complacent and happy from having years of easy success. So it's devastating. And it's also very expensive, because I've watched this happen where month after month after month after month, the person doesn't produce. But senior management says, well, they're a superstar. They're going to produce. I know their track record. So we wait. And by the time you're into the second year and they haven't sold anything meaningful, or as you said, if their network has run out and now they're not bringing in new people because there's no one else that they know, it becomes a very expensive proposition for the company that's investing all this money in this supposed sales superstar. So I think one of the keys when we're interviewing and recruiting is we have a very tight filter and we don't fall in love with somebody's reputation. We should fall in love with their hunger and their skill set, right? And their mindset that they bring to the job. And one of my favorite interview questions, Matt, is when you're hiring someone who's supposed to hunt for new business, I ask them in the interview, would you please tell me three recent sales success stories? And I want the whole story, from how you picked the target account to how you got in, to how you built relationships, to how you advanced the deal, how you built consensus, how you dealt with objections. And you know, different businesses have different levels of complexity to the sale. Here I'm describing a more complex one. But the key thing here, everyone listen, management, listen to this. You need to hear the story, not just of how they closed it, but how they opened it. Most companies don't have closing problems. they have opening problems. My friend Anthony Anarino and I talk about this a lot, right? I think he's the smartest guy in the US in the sales business, Anthony Anarino. And
I've read his books as well.
Yeah, he's so cerebral. He's so smart. And he goes, his phrase is, everyone is opportunity starved. So what I want to make sure when I'm interviewing someone, particularly with a track record of success, it's another thing entirely to have to scratch business out of the dirt and turn over rocks and create the opportunity from scratch. I want to hear those stories. And if they don't have those stories, I push back. And you realize when they start telling you, well, I got this opportunity. Well, no. How did you create the opportunity? And it changes everything because all of a sudden that person doesn't have answers for you.
How would you like the answer to be framed, Mike? If you were listening to it, how would you like it to be framed? Because I know your process from New Sales Simplified, and I've used it and I've taught similar methods to the sales teams that I've been involved with. How would you like the answer to be framed? Would you like, let me just give you one answer and then you can. So the first answer would be, oh, I got the lead from a marketing inbound team. They passed it over to me and then I went out and closed it.
Yeah. And you know what? And I joke about that in my books that's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. The problem is, whether it's inbound marketing or social selling or referral selling or plug it in, whatever it is, the reason companies have sales problems is because salespeople sit on their ass and they wait for that lead. And if we had an incredible marketing engine and all the work you did on social media and all the intellectual property you put out and all the trade shows you attended, right? And all the inbound marketing drew enough opportunities for you to work and keep the funnel full, you wouldn't need to create your own. But in 100% of the companies where I have helped them and they have a sales shortfall, the problem is the inbound marketing isn't enough to keep the funnel full. So the question I would ask back to the person that told me the story about inbound marketing, I would say, that's great, Joe. I love when we get leads. In fact, we get a lot of leads. We put out intellectual property. I speak. We have a blog. We even have this other team that sometimes creates opportunities or meetings for us. But when those leads are not sufficient, Joe, tell me what you do to create your own sales opportunities when the funnel isn't full enough, when your pipeline is insufficient and there are not enough deals in there for you to make your number this month or this quarter. Tell me how you create opportunities. What do you do? And that's where you get them to talk about, well, I have a target account list and I've worked on my messaging and here's how I prospect. I'm a believer in the phone and email and social media messaging and I combine the three and this is my cadence and here's how I create messages and this is how I push past resistance. And if I hear someone talk like that, I start drooling. I'm like, oh, yeah. I've got someone who knows how to create business. I have a hunter on the hook here. So that's the direction I would take that conversation.
You do have a chapter in Sales Truth, which debunks faux sales experts and the people that say the sales process has changed. I don't think it's changed, and I'm sure you're the same. I think it's evolved. And I go back to the story about the guy with the catalog. How do you think, do you think that social media and inbound marketing adds to our sales patter and our sales tools, or do you think it detracts from the sales skills that we should have been taught firsthand?
That is a brilliant question. That's a deep question. Here's what I would say. I would like to argue that social media and inbound marketing are very helpful indeed, because it's another vehicle. And as my friend Jeb Blunt, who wrote Fanatical Prospecting, always says, we should use every ethical means to get a prospective client's attention. I love, and this is why it's so weird when I preach against the charlatans in the social selling and the inbound marketing world, because they tell you the lie that everything has changed and that prospecting doesn't work. But I sound like a hypocrite when I say it, because I love social selling. A lot of my business comes from putting out intellectual property and LinkedIn posts and my books. And your friendship with me, we started on Instagram. That's how we met.
Yeah.
We didn't know each other. Now I'm following you and I'm learning a ton. And we'll probably end up in some, who knows, in a year we might be in London together doing some joint event. So I love social, but it's a supplement. It's not a replacement for the traditional selling. And I'm with you. Everything has not changed. We have new tools. And we have a larger tech stack, but sometimes those tools and that technology become a giant distraction from the very basics. And for those of you that are watching this on video, I'm holding up my phone. The phone is still your best weapon. And today, especially during the coronavirus craze, the last few months, the phone has made a huge comeback. And the phone was already having a resurrection, per se, because there's so much spamming. There's so much pathetic email marketing. There are so many people on LinkedIn who do the dreaded connect, then pitch. Oh, yeah. Exactly. Like, you know, you can tell as soon as you read their profile, I'm going to accept this invitation. And by tomorrow morning, I'll have a spammy, self-focused message with a calendar link in the message from some weak salesperson who's sending out automated messaging or is too scared to pick up the phone. And I can't wait to hear your take on this. But so social is a great help. And you can listen and you can engage with people, but the real sales hunters still incorporate old skill stuff, old school stuff, and they pick up the phone. I want your take on, because I saw your reaction.
I had the exact scenario yesterday, Mike. I had the exact same scenario. Some guy who I'm not connected with, have no affiliate, any mutual connections on LinkedIn, sent me an invitation. And he had a half-decent intro, just saying, I've seen that you have quite a wide network. We work in similar industries, but I'd like to reach out and connect with you. So I thought, okay, I'll connect with you. Yesterday, I received not one, but two messages, both with calendar links, both saying, I'd like to reach out to you and see if I can help improve your business. He hasn't even asked me about my business. He hasn't even asked what frustrations or what pain points we've got. He just reached out and said, book a call with me. That's truly weak. I used to manage a guy who would never ever pick up the phone, never ever email. He would email an Outlook calendar invite to say, this is the meeting we're going to have, which again, it's truly frustrating when you're a client. Going back to the social selling, every time I connect with someone on LinkedIn, I send them a message, ask them how they are, because it's relationship building. It's exactly the same as if we get a new client. And I was dealing with a client today who, before I joined the company, we lost 3-4 years ago. And I emailed them to introduce myself, said, this is the new process that we've introduced. This is the new company culture. Your sales team rep will be more in touch with you. I'd like to arrange a meeting. I don't like doing stuff over email. I'd like to arrange a meeting or a Zoom call because of the current climate to just meet with you, understand what your pain points are. We've got the order already without me even having to meet with him. And we haven't had this client for 4 years. It's just about being personal. And when people think that they can just blindly send you calendar invites or blindly send you messages, and you're suddenly going to go, oh, yes, please. It's like walking into a bar and going, looking at a woman and going, marry me. You're skipping the whole relationship point.
It might even be worse than that. I mean, it's so off-putting. What's interesting in my world, and you're going to start getting this now because your brand is getting a nice following in the sales world. You're going to start getting all these invites from people whose specialty is creating leads for coaches and consultants. You're probably getting them now.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
And what's interesting is you look at their profile and you think, you want to generate leads for me? I have more. I could buy you 50 times over. You want to be my lead generation engine? And this is how you're going to get leads. You're going to pitch and connect and pitch and send automated messages. I mean, I laugh because I have 10 times the business of the people offering to help me grow my business, and I'm doing it the old-fashioned way. And I think it's a scam. And that's why I love when a salesperson, because I get to make fun of it, when they keep emailing you the same message over and over and say, did you get my last message? I'm surprised you haven't responded yet. And I'm thinking, first of all, if I'm really important to you, pick up the phone and call me. And if you leave me multiple voicemail messages and they're decent and there's some value in what you're saying, I'll call you back. But emailing me the same message over and over or sending me automated messages on LinkedIn, you haven't earned the right. When you earn the right with perseverance and creativity and personalizing your messaging, and you when you wear somebody down because you're trying really hard and you bring your personality and you're including contextualized messaging because you've done some research, then someone may call you back. But if you're just sending spam, you're worth nothing. We don't even need you. We could hire a bot to do that. That's not sales. You should expect nothing in return from those efforts. So I just want to get that off my chest. Thank you.
Yeah, no, totally. Mike, I've got one more question before I ask you the five questions. Sure. And it's quite another deep one, actually. Your books have been translated into many different languages now. Do you think the sales process and the sales culture that you and I are accustomed to applies in other cultures as well? So I'm talking the Latin American cultures. Do you think it's universal?
It's an interesting question. I've traveled to 5 continents to speak and to lead workshops. Most of the sales issues are the same, but there are some cultural things that really are different in the Middle East
yeah,
and in Asia. It seems to me in my clients in South America and in Europe, it's very similar to what it is here in North America. The typical prospecting behavior works and people are receptive in some sense to being interrupted if it's done well. I have realized that the culture is so strong and the norms are so different in the Arabic world, in the Middle East, and clearly in Asia. There are some formalities that really alter the way selling takes place. So, and I am not an expert in either of those. I have clients there that have shown me, and I realize that my content, and well, New Sales Simplified has been translated into Vietnamese and simplified Mandarin. And, wow. and I have, there are people adopting it there, but I'm not as comfortable because there are mores. So I don't want to speak too strongly. What I will say though, Matt, sales management is the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
Culture, accountability, talent management. Because I've seen in my international clients, the sales management issues in Korea and Australia and Brazil are the same as they are here in North America. It's sales that's different. But I would say in your world, and I have a lot of friends in the UK, from my sons who are Premier League football nuts, one Arsenal and one Liverpool. The Liverpool kid is much happier this year.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And then my clients that are there, it's, boy, we are really, I mean, there are some words that we don't agree on because of the way we see things, but very similar selling best practices across the pond.
I would argue. Back at you, Mike, because I not only look after the UK operations, but I look after the North American operations for this company that I run now. And I've sat in sales meetings with representatives in North America, and it's exactly the same process. Discovery, then discussing pain points, then seeing if we've got a product or a service that fits, and then doing the close. But there's that banter and there's that discussion in between and just that relationship building. So it's 100% the same. It's just that, yeah, the language nuances and the differences in between microcultures, I like to sort it. So we'll drink tea, you'll drink Pepsi.
That's great.
So we're coming up to the end of the podcast, Mike, and I do this on every podcast, but we ask the same five questions.
I know, I'm nervous now. I'm nervous about these. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'll ask them in any order. So what would be the worst job that you could ever do and why?
Engineer or architect, because I'm just not that precise and I would give up about 1 hour into the equation and bridges would be falling down and buildings would be unstable if I was an architect. I'm not a scientist. So
are you the same as me, Mike? Because I have a real problem with the detail. I like sales in terms of building relationships and then getting the close and understanding what the client wants. But the actual detail and getting it into a spreadsheet and passing
barely use a spreadsheet. Now, I am good with detail in selling process, right? I can understand and diagnose the flow, but spatially and engineering and Excel formulas, I have no interest in. What now that I'm 52 years old, I refuse to do them.
What did you want to be when you grew up, Mike?
A baseball player, U.S. baseball. That was just my sport as a kid. And I knew it would never be possible, but I dreamt about it for a long time.
And at 52 years old, are you still hoping for that dream? You're still hoping for the call-up?
I am not. I'm hoping that we could actually watch some live sports with this pandemic going on at some point. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Which leader do you look up to the most?
Okay. I am not pandering to you and your UK audience by saying this, but I studied Winston Churchill about 2 years ago. I read several books. I've watched a couple movies. And boy, do I long for a leader like him right now, particularly in my country. A man who could preach hope, who was eccentric and quirky, had his issues for sure, but understood the importance of bringing people together and a common mission and a purpose and winning against very bad odds.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you are completely pandering to the UK audience there.
No, I'm not pandering.
What's the biggest sales mistake that you've ever made, Mike?
It's in the story in chapter 13 in New Sales Simplified. I deferred to my selling partner's sales process, and we failed miserably because I went into a very big meeting with the president of a billion-dollar company, and we did a presentation without doing discovery, and we fell flat, and we were self-focused, and we told the terrible story. And I that day, I was a young man, and it was just 20 years ago, I said, I will never, ever defer to letting someone else dictate how we're gonna sell. We never should have gone in there and done what we did. We should have asked questions on the front end, and we should have asked questions when we got in the room. And I'll never, ever, ever let someone make a presentation or do a demo before we actually do discovery and probe and understand the customer situation.
Oh man, that must hurt. That must have hurt.
It did hurt. But it also put me on the path to what I'm doing today. So it was probably a very valuable day in my life. So
yeah, yeah. And the final question, Mike, is what was the last book that you read?
I read the book Inked, I-N-K-E-D, Inked by my friend Jeb Blunt, because I wrote the foreword to it.
It's on my bookcase, just behind this screen. It's on my bookcase.
Oh, too funny. I have it. It's up there on the left. You probably can't read the title, but...
I can see it. Yeah, yeah, I recognize the wording.
It's about closing deals and negotiating, and that's not one of my strengths, negotiating. And it was really helpful to read Jeb Blunt's take on it. Because what he proved for me was that it's not all about negotiating. It's about selling from an abundance mentality and having plenty of deals in the pipeline and knowing your stuff so that you don't have to sell on price. And it was just, it had some great negotiation tactics as well, but it was such a well-rounded book. I can't wait to see how it impacts the sales community.
Where can people find more information on you, Mike?
Oh, my website's probably the best place, mikeweinberg.com, W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G. And on social media, where you and I are hanging out these days, it's Mike _ Weinberg.
Have you got another book coming out, Mike? Have you got anything in the works?
Not right now. We're launching online content, and we're to help companies right now get through this crisis. And books are wonderful. They're a great credibility piece. It's a great marketing piece. I love the impact and the notes I get from people that read them. It's not a huge amount of revenue when you sell, I'm an author, I get royalties, but I'm not a celebrity. So the real business comes from what the book creates. Yeah. And my wife has told me no books for the next couple of years because the last one almost killed me. It's really hard to be busy and traveling and have a full workload and write a book on the side. I need to maximize the revenue and the impact the books are making versus writing the next book right now.
Nice. Thanks for coming on, Mike.
Oh, Matt, what a treat. I can't wait to see you in person somewhere. You'll be here again, or I'll be in your place, and it'll be fun to get together and toast.
Have that beer.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.